Hello, everybody, and welcome to the H2O Talk podcast. I'm your host, Tom Bellinger, and our guest co-host today is Mr. Greg Dewey from the northern part of our state. He works for Northern Water as an engineer. And today we're going to have a little bit of maybe a Halloween type of podcast. But we'll get into that in a moment. Greg, how are you doing today?
I'm good, but I just got chills as soon as you said we were going to do a Halloween-type podcast today.
Oh, it's that time of year, and you know that the H2O Talk Studios here, they're on top of all this stuff, and they know Halloween's coming.
I can't wait.
Okay. Well, let's just talk a little bit about some environmental/water news. And this is just one little article I thought was interesting. And this, the headline is, it comes out of University of York, which is in the United Kingdom. And the headline is, experts warn of risk of civil unrest in the United Kingdom due to food shortages. Basically, there's a shortage of popular carbohydrates such as wheat, bread, pasta, cereal, and this has to do with climate change. And essentially, they're looking at some of these crops, maybe more difficulty in growing them. So people that have been working across academia, people in government, people in charities, people in business, essentially are saying that the frailties within the United Kingdom's food system has been led, or basically is showing as far as with the more extreme weather happening. This is probably not anything new. I think people have thought about this being a possibility with crops, but the interesting part is what they say is civil unrest is classified as over 30,000 people suffering violent injury, and this could be through loss of calories. Just over 40% of the food experts surveyed believe that civil unrest in the UK in the next 10 years was possible due to this. So again, kind of the collateral issues that extend overpopulation, but also to the situation and unknowns with climate change, and that could be tied to water and temperature for growing crops, that type of thing. So it just kind of struck me as an interesting, and it was kind of extreme to me, but I hope that does not happen. So,
yeah, that sounds like a zombie apocalypse in the making.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought I would bring that one up, and it's funny, people are trying to not eat carbs, but carbs are needed in your diet, so that could be a situation. The other thing that you and I, of course, and everyone else has been looking in the news has been the situation in Gaza, basically with food and power and everything cut off. And without water or good quality water, it doesn't take long for a real crisis to occur. You want to talk a little bit about crime scenes and water?
Yeah, I'm really curious about this connection between crime scenes and water. I understand that you've been doing some work with an entity called NecroSearch International.
Yes, I've been with NecroSearch International almost 20 years, 19 plus years. And it's not a well-known organization. Matter of fact, there might be 50 of us in it. There's probably maybe active people might be 20 to 30, I'm going to guess. And what the organization is, it's nonprofit. It was started in the late 1980s to assist law enforcement agencies with cases that they've run into a brick wall with. The way we're structured is like environmental science is multidisciplinary. We are essentially a multidisciplinary group of eggheads, I guess, and also a bunch of retired and active duty law enforcement people. And it was primarily mostly the scientists and that were running this for years, but we've brought more of the law enforcement experts in too. So it's nonprofit, and they've been operating, like I said, since the late 80s.
And I understand that they're based out of Colorado.
Yes, and originally the organization was exclusive to Colorado residents. Mainly this was because of trying to get people together to meet once a month for a business meeting and case study, case evaluations and things. But with the advent of things like Zoom and all of that, I was president of the organization for a few years. And during that time, we started looking at breaking down those borders and bringing people outside of Colorado in, because there's a lot of talent. So we have people from around the country. We have, for example, we have an agreement, kind of a cooperation with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They have a rapid response team of retired law enforcement people that go out in cases for basically kids under 18 that are missing or presumed to be in a homicide, something like that. We reached out to them, and several of their Team Adam members, which is a rapid response team, joined us. So we're more of a mix of maybe 50-50 from, say, academia or science, and the other 50% is going to be some of these law enforcement folks.
I understand that necro is a word that refers to death, and so this is recovering remains of dead people?
It's essentially looking for clandestine graves, which would be, you know, victims may be buried in the forest or something, and evidence. So it's interesting how it started and how we got our name. Back in the late 80s, there's a gentleman here in Denver area. He's a geophysicist, and he was watching the television one day. Douglas County, I believe it was, Sheriff's Department, was out looking for some suspected people that were buried in 50-gallon drums. So they're showing them on TV, and they're running metal detectors over the area. And he was looking at it, and his son was sitting next to him, and he said, you know, they're never going to find anybody that way. That's not going to work. So his son said, well, what should they be doing? And I think he was talking about magnetometers and more of the geophysical instruments that he's used to. And he says, yeah. And he says, well, why don't you call them? So this guy is, he's kind of a one of our class clouds, and keeps us going. Anyway, he picked up the phone and called the sheriff's department in Douglas County and said, I got some information about the dead bodies you're looking for, and hung up. This is at least the way he tells the story. And of course, like 5 minutes later, there's cops at his door. So he explained to him, and he went out to the field with him. I think they did actually find the hood of a car using his equipment, but did not find the victims. But he, at least they know where they're not, which is a small victory. And he eventually started talking to a gentleman who was a kind of a crime scene photographer, had this idea that, you know, maybe we could help more law enforcement agencies. So they started to meet for breakfast, and they kind of got a few more people that they knew together, and it started to grow. And then they decided, well, we could form this organization. But they were called the Pig People because they have a site, a research site, at a law enforcement facility in Douglas County. And essentially they bury pigs, which are fairly similar to humans. And then we're going to look at how the graves changed and what kind of insects came and what happened to the ground and how their equipment measured it. So they were kind of doing some research in the beginning, but they thought, you know, we don't want to be called the Pig People. And this guy who basically was on that first case, his son went up to him and says, you know, how about necro search? And he thought, okay, we'll go with that. So that's basically how the name came. So this was late 80s. I did not become a part of it until 2004, so about 20 years ago.
So how did you get connected with this group?
You know, it's interesting. I knew a gentleman in the Bureau of Reclamation. He's an archaeologist. I'll mention his name. He's passed since a few years ago, but Steve Ireland is his name. And I worked with Steve in Amarillo when I was down there with the Bureau of Rec. He eventually left the Bureau and kind of got into this business. He worked for the coroner's office in Denver. And anyway, one night I got a phone call, and it said Steve Ireland on the ID. And I thought, Steve Ireland, why is he calling me? I haven't heard from Steve in years. And I picked up, and Steve said, you know, one of the skills or one of the disciplines we're lacking is hydrology. And I wonder if you might want to come to a meeting and consider maybe joining us, you know, if they like you and you like them. So I said, yeah, that sounds like it would be fascinating. I remember I had thought of that, but I knew he was doing this kind of work as an archaeologist. But I thought, that's kind of cool, but maybe his skills are more needed. So anyway, I did go to I did start attending meetings and eventually became a provisional member for a year and then got full membership. And I've been on the board several times. I've been president of the organization. And it's very unique way. You never know. I tell my students sometimes, you never know where your skills will take you. I never expected to do this, but this has been a very actually fulfilling part of my life, even though it sounds a little creepy to some people.
It's fascinating. I'm trying to understand how your expertise in water and hydrology is connected to this type of work.
So among our disciplines that we have, so I'm hydrology, but we have a meteorologist. We have an engineer we had one and he passed away. So maybe think about it, Greg. We could get you into this. But engineering can be important. Geophysics, geology. We have a world-class forensic anthropologist, board certified. Naturalists, botanists, biologists, some people that work in labs, crime labs. We have the people from the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they have their own kind of expertise. One's a computer forensic guy. Another one is a search and rescue guy. Another one is a landfill guy, because things end up in landfills sometimes. And I know I'm missing a couple of them, but a lot of the sciences and a lot of these law enforcement people with their disciplines, we kind of tie our brains together. And if, let's say you have a case, we only work for law enforcement. So let's say you think your Uncle Harry is buried in your neighbor's backyard. And you call us and say, could you come out? I think my Uncle Harry's buried in my neighbor's backyard. We would say, have you called the cops? And if they haven't, we'll say, please call the cops. Now, if you want to mention that you've talked to us, that's fine, because not all law enforcement agencies work for us. But essentially, they have to go to the police. They have to go through law enforcement. So we've worked in pretty much all 50 states. We've worked in 10 countries. And we've worked Interpol, and we've worked with sheriffs, departments, police departments, FBI, all those agencies that get involved. And so if the law enforcement agency is there, they can call us. But we don't necessarily push ourselves on people. There are some other organizations out there that might do that, but we are very low key. So a lot of times we'll get a case, and let's say it's a missing child, somebody may have been abducted or something, and we will essentially take that case on. We'll talk about it. They have to fill out a questionnaire on the case, and we call them and we do some brainstorming, and then we sometimes have them give a presentation, but not always. And then we essentially talk about the case and strategies and what we can do, and then we might go out in the field, or we might just act as consultants to the law enforcement agency, which I've been doing a lot of lately on a couple of cases involving people lost in rivers. But even though I'm a water guy, we cross paths with all of our other disciplines. So, in hydrology, the geophysics helps, the geologists help us, the people that are the environmental type, botanists and, et cetera, those different disciplines, all kind of intermingle with my field. So we learn from each other. And I might see something that somebody else doesn't do, even though there's not a body of water involved. We all get involved in all the cases. We assign a team to evaluate the case and a team manager. And then essentially we'll either go out to the field or just basically do it remotely. Sometimes we can just give them information. So that's kind of how it works.
So you've come a long way from calling the cops and saying, I know where the bodies are, and hanging up, to them calling you and asking, where are the bodies? We need your help.
Yeah. And we've actually...
That's amazing.
We've been on a couple of those forensic type shows. Deep Forensics, I was on one of their episodes, kind of filling in for somebody. But we're a little shy of the public attention. There's a book which you can still buy probably, I don't know if it's exactly in print, but a year before I joined, a gentleman by the name of Steve Jackson wrote a book called No Stone Unturned. And it's about necrosurge. And it's about some of their early cases that they cut their teeth on and they were successful on. And Steve is working on a sequel, but we've been approached by a couple of organizations like that want to do a TV series or they want to do something like that. And we've kind of not sure if that's the way we want to go. We would rather be in the background. And I wouldn't do it unless Tom Selleck played me, but, you know, so we try to work, you know, if we're working with the police and let's say the newspapers show up to a case, we'll let them talk to them. Unless they want us to talk to them, we won't do it. So we're kind of working for them and giving them the advice or we're going out. And we've had successes. If we sometimes don't find anything, we at least know a piece of evidence where they're not. And maybe they've been focusing on the wrong area for a long time.
This is really intriguing. I was wondering if you could either talk about a type of case or even give an example case.
Sure.
And you could certainly change all the names so you can protect the innocent.
Okay. Well, we have, I've worked on several, and they're not all necessarily water, but water is part of the environment. And you think of a crime scene as an environment. It could be indoors. It could be outdoors, but moisture and things are going to play a role. So I'm always learning things, but I'll talk about maybe the first case I worked on. I was still a provisional member, but my friend Steve, who brought me in, his wife, she was the sheriff's deputy. And there's a case out in western Colorado, and that case was near Delta. And there was a young female that was essentially kidnapped, murdered, and there's a small lake, I guess, in the city, and apparently the person threw her in that lake and weighed her down, but started thinking about it and decided maybe she would come up and they would find her. So he took her out of the lake at some point and went way back into the backcountry and threw into an old arroyo. And so we knew this. We knew potentially that about where she was, could have been, or at least put back there. So Steve, his wife, and I basically went out to Delta, and we met with the police agency. We talked about the case and all of the different things that had happened. And then we went out in the field. So she had been missing for about 14 years. And the police were very involved in this because some of them went to high school with her or knew her when she was younger. And they had been searching in this area for about 14 years. And they would like take cadets from the police academy and bring them out. They would search and search and never came up with anything. So they called us. So we're kind of maybe one of your last resort types of options to bring in. And Steve, and I don't know if you knew Steve, but Steve's dad was a hydrologist with the Bureau of Reclamation. And I did not know that until this time out in the field. So Steve knew some of the hydrology, but he, being an archaeologist, is used to going around rivers that maybe are going to be modified or that they're going to build a dam. And he's going to look for ancient cultural sites. Maybe it's an old Native American campground. It's an ancient site of some sort that they want to at least preserve or they want to study before maybe they do the change to the environment, like building a dam or something like that. So he's a field guy. And we went out and we walked over the area, and then independently, because we don't want to influence each other, Steve took off and I took off. And we started walking the scene. We looked where the police had looked before. There was an old Bureau of Land Management dam on that arroyo that was essentially filled in. And we kind of independently walked the area for a couple hours, 2-3 hours. And I never found anything, but I had some ideas. And Steve at the same time did not find anything, but he had some ideas. And we essentially went back to meet each other, and I said, well, any ideas? And he said, yeah, I've got a few, and I had a few. Well, essentially, we landed on a similar conclusion, was below this dam, there was a bunch of boulders, and there was a bunch of sediment that had settled, and we both independently decided that that vegetation in that sediment was about 14, 16 years old. So I thought, you know, this is a place where material could be trapped. You know, pieces of her clothing. I think she was maybe wrapped in a plastic bag or something. Pieces of that might be there, you know. So we got the police officers all together and discussed what we had done, what we had looked at, what our conclusions were. And they said, well, okay, well, that's great, because we've been looking, you know, 500 yards downriver. We have never been in this area. So where do we start? And Steve and I looked at each other and said, well, how about like right where we're standing, right here? And we did find enough of her to identify her. So we knew where she was. So that was kind of, you know, after all those years, and I considered that to be beginner's luck, because it's always not that easy. I can talk about another case on the Western Slope.
What a great thing, though, for her family to have closure.
That's the big thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because it does bring closure to the families, and it brought closure to some of those police officers. And for us, it's like, ah, you know, we've done something. So this case can be closed. So that's a reward we get from that.
That's great. That's a great story. Tell me about another case.
Another one I'll just talk about briefly. It's a case that has not ever concluded in the courtroom, but it was out near, it was a place called Cottonwood Creek, and it's in Lake County, Colorado, so it's kind of southwest. There's a lot of vacation homes up there. A lot of people from Texas have really nice cabins and things. And there was a physician who was late 40s, and her husband owned a place up there, and they were out of Texas. She fell or was pushed off of maybe a 15-foot cliff into this Cottonwood Creek. And the story was that her husband tried to catch her because she was being whooshed downstream and never couldn't catch up to her. So he went to the nearest place he could find. He called 911. And the police showed up within 30 minutes, and they started looking for her. Well, they did find her eventually, 150, 200 feet or so, not too far downstream. And she had drowned. Her head was kind of under a log, and she had drowned. So the detectives that went out on this, and I really gained a lot of respect for a lot of the investigators that do this, because these guys really use some excellent critical thinking. They interviewed the husband, and of course, a lot of times the husband's going to be a suspect. And some of the things in his story didn't quite match. For example, they had a dog, and he said, oh yeah, the dog got tangled in her legs and she fell off. They saw evidence of a scuffle, but she also had the dog leash in her pocket when they found her. So there were some inconsistencies, and they went through basically an investigation, and they did a pretty smart thing. They hired a guy to come in with a mannequin that you can weigh down and mimic the person weight-wise, and they tried to get this mannequin to flow downstream. The unique thing about this case is they had pictures taken, because he took a picture of her like minutes before she went over the cliff. So we had pictures of the background and the water and all of that. The next day they came and took measurements of the water, but a day had gone by. Essentially what they did is they decided that the husband was a suspect, and they went to trial. And there was a hydrologist that defended him, and the police department kind of went through their investigation. They hired a hydrographer that measures stream flow from the state. They had this mannequin type of study that they did, and they felt that the water flow at the time that she fell in was not enough to swoosh her downstream. She would have been hung up in a pool or two, especially in that short of time. So that was what their case was. They concluded with the jury 11-1 to acquit. So there was one person that felt that the guy might have done it. And funny thing was, Greg, he was an engineer. And so it was a hung jury. And then they decided to have another case or another trial. And that's when I came into it. And they had a lot of evidence. And I went through all of the evidence. I did a little hydrologic investigation. Basically, I was trying to figure out what the flow was when she went in. And I was going to try to figure out, was that enough flow to actually move her downstream? the studies that they had, the parts of the studies that they had were the photographs. And there's a photograph of the victim, and behind her you can see flows in the rocks. And they thought of this too, but what it was, the rocks, it was solid bedrock across the stream, and the water channeled into a little notch and went down. So to me, that looked like a weir. And I said, if we could go out and try different flows and make it repeatable, but we can measure the different flows at different heights along the rocks, maybe we could look at the picture of when that happened and determine what the flow was. So they tried to do some flow studies. They took pictures, they had a lot of things. And my only wish was, I wish you guys had done this at a higher flow rate, like right after a thunderstorm, because that would give more conclusive evidence that at a higher flow than you thought it was, and if she couldn't go downstream, that might be the linchpin. So anyway,
it's like developing a rating curve
exactly
for this controlled section. And so if you can bracket this curve with the low flows and the high flows, as long as you are doing that, then you can get an estimate of something in between those two points.
Yeah, yeah. And but so you could draw a curve and then you could kind of mark it. Basically, when it went to trial, they moved the trial to Broomfield, Colorado here from across the state. I was on the witness stand for a while and trying to explain what I did and what this weird thing was that we were using. The other side had another hydrologist. He also was very experienced. We both had over 30 years experience. So it was kind of us against each other. But I told him that I thought he did a good analysis. I did things a little differently, but we ended up in the same ballpark. But the one thing I thought we needed was the photographic evidence of that little weir area. And they kind of dismissed that because of wave action. But I thought wave action around other rocks would have dismissed it. But this area had more of a laminar flow going through it, a more of a steady flow. So the only problem was I did not really have any data for higher flows. So we were kind of like really close, about 10 cubic feet per second. We were just a little below that. And that's what they said. Well, you guys did it on too low a flow. It was just a little flow below that, but I think it was a consistent level of flow to maybe prove the case. And what I told the detectives was, if we could go back and we could measure it at maybe 14 cubic feet per second or 12 or 13, I think that would give more conclusive evidence. Well, the thing was, is the judge wanted the case kind of settled and done. We didn't have the time, and it wasn't the time of year to do it. So we never could get back out in the field to do that. So essentially, we went through the second trial, and this time we had 8 to convict and 4 to acquit. Still a hung jury, and now time has passed, and I don't know if I would trust going out there and doing it in that same spot, because things might have changed a little bit. So the gentleman was not convicted or anything. It was a hung jury. And I think the state attorney here decided that they didn't have the time to pursue it, so we're just going to put it on the shelf, and if something comes up in the future, maybe we could retry it. So that case ended up again as a hung jury. But you know, I thought it was an interesting way of studying. We've tried a lot of unique approaches to these cases. Just a real quick one, worked on a case up in Wyoming on the Wind River. And a person was supposedly in a field, and the scent travels through vegetation, but also with water, say if a victim is decomposing in the ground. And we have people with dogs that can go out, cadaver dogs, and they can check. And this geologist that went up with me and a couple other people, we realized that there was a gravel lens layer in the ground. And we thought it was about 3 feet deep, and we thought, you know, if we could dig a bunch of wells, shallow wells, and position them around this field, and then have a vent come out of those wells for scent, because the dogs hit in a couple places, but we wanted to see if we could repeat it with these wells. And we had dogs essentially go out and hit the wells or not hit other wells, and on the wells that they hit on, we could triangulate that back to a potential spot where the victim was. And we did that. We came up with some conclusions. But the landowner at the time said, get these wells out of here. So we had to leave. So it was something that, you know, we could have maybe written a paper about. But again, it was sometimes we tried different things that have never been tried before. Sometimes it's straightforward. But again, there's always some component of water involved in these cases.
That's fascinating. I mean, did you ever think that while you were studying hydrology that it could be used in a way like this?
No, I've never in my wildest dreams ever thought of that. And that one phone call from my archaeologist friend, it was like, yeah, I think that would be really cool to do. And maybe, you know, maybe I can help them with something. And they've had a lot of water cases, you know, cars gone into rivers, and sometimes they float up a tributary, which nobody would think of. All sorts of little things like that. There was, in one case, a spring on a hillside near a stream, and the dogs kept hitting on it, but they couldn't figure out why until somebody says, maybe there's a well upstream. And sure enough, a victim was in a well, and their scent traveled through the groundwater to the spring. And that's how they found the person. So just odds and ends, but very, very professional people. It's a family. That's the thing I like about it. It's a family. The egos are taken off the shelf, although people could have big egos in what they do. But they kind of put them on the shelf, and we try to see if we can solve the case or come up with a way of doing it.
Sounds very rewarding. What would you say are some of the rewards of doing this?
Well, some of it is, one reward is to get back out in the field once in a while. And that kind of keeps me a little sharper in that area because I don't do that much anymore. Working with some of the wonderful people from the police department, the detectives, the investigators, very professional. A lot of these people give away a lot of their personal time. Some of them are extremely passionate about certain cases. And like, you know, this might be their weekend because we tend to be volunteers. So we go up and travel to different places. And that's been really rewarding. And I have a lot of respect for these people, the amount of time and passion that they put into their jobs. And just the idea of trying to figure out something like this is kind of rewarding. And if you do find a victim, or at least find a clue towards another leg of an investigation that might help, that's also rewarding. And we do research. We've had people going to Russia for the past 5 years. Now, they're not going there now, but they had been looking for the last Tsar of Russia, who was murdered 24 hours after his brother was killed in 1917. That was Tsar Nicholas was killed, and his brother Mikhail lived about a day later. And eventually, the theory is that they took him out in the woods and killed him and buried him. And there's been a Russian team and some other people from other organizations and a couple people from our organization looking for him for about four summers. But, you know, I think they felt they were getting closer, but with the way everything's going in that part of the world right now, we're not sending them. So some of those things are also kind of cool, doing a little research on the side.
Yeah. Are you still quite active in Colorado then?
Yeah. You know, I'd say the bulk of our cases, since we're more well-known here, are in Colorado. But, I mean, I haven't been really out of the country, but I've been on the West Coast, several states in between. I have a case of a homicide in 1935 that's kind of been put on the shelf for a while, I think, due to budgets. But it was a couple that was murdered and burned and thrown off a bridge in New Mexico in 1935. Now, I don't know if we'll get any luck with that because the bridge is rebuilt, but sometimes you might find something. So some of our people were on the JonBenet Ramsey case running ground-penetrating radar through the house. So we have a lot of that equipment we can use. There was a Clark Rockefeller case, a gentleman who claimed he was a Rockefeller and may have killed three people in the East Coast and the West Coast, been on that. I think we've gotten Jimmy Hoffa calls. Lately, I've had a few cases like in upstate New York and Vermont that I've consulted on and haven't traveled to. So it's interesting. And one of the things I'm doing right now is working with a group of people trying to come up with standards, national standards for investigating aquatic crime scenes. And that's a lot more complicated than I thought it would be, but we're putting together a manual and maybe a textbook on that someday. So it leads to new things, and I keep that on my high priority list of things when they happen. I've enjoyed it. It's some things are it's horrifying sometimes, the stuff that goes on out there, especially when it comes to children. You know, I've been to a FBI truck stop school when they talk about all the issues there. Drowning, the FBI had a course on that. That was fascinating. And I'll just mention, since it's water, but in that class, they said that, you know, somebody dies in a swimming pool, somebody dies in a bathtub, somebody dies swimming in a lake. It's a terrible tragedy. It's a terrible accident. But at the time, I don't know if it's changed, the FBI was saying that they figure about 75% might involve foul play, instead of being like maybe 25%, which I would have thought it was, but they say it's much higher.
Oh, that's terrible. Well, it sounds like this work has really born out of a phone call and led to writing standards that are going to help many other people in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you for doing that. And I can't wait to see this, the work that comes out of this.
Yeah. And even people like you, Greg, you might consider, with your technical background, that could be something to be involved in. You know, and we ask why people don't bite, and some people do, but it's been rewarding for me anyway.
It's fascinating. I love a good mystery, and I like watching these shows, but to think that technical skills that I or others have could be used to actually solve a crime and make a difference in somebody's life and death is really something.
Okay. Well, so. I'm glad we brought it up. It's a good time of year to bring it up. And so a couple things, since we're, I guess, pretty much at time, I was going to mention to you is I know in future episodes we might have a person that is more of a like an archivist, water archivist in the future.
Yes. So instead of digging around grave sites, he's digging around papers that people have written and have passed on and kept them in an archive. And she's in charge of what's called the Water Resources Archive at the Colorado State University.
That would be interesting.
So she's a good friend of Tom Check. And she also, I don't think she thought she was going to get into this line of work, but it's really become something that a lot of people rely on when you're trying to understand what was going through the mind of, say, Delph Carpenter when he was thinking about the Colorado River Compact.
Yeah.
You could go back to his papers and also his papers when he was a young attorney and understand a little more of his thought process and get a feel for who this guy was.
That would be fascinating. I look forward. So maybe in November sometime?
Yes.
Okay. And there's a person I've been talking to, and she's an environmental engineer, and recently started to work at Metropolitan State University of Denver here in the engineering department. And she has a lot of expertise with a lot of things, but one of the things she's been working on in recent years has been microplastics. And I thought she would be really good because, you know, if I go out to lunch with her, she likes to joke around, like I'll have a plastic glass full of something, and I'm drinking. She says, you know, you're drinking some microplastics. You know, or people around us have straws. And she says, hey, they're taking some microplastics. So she's interesting. She's kind of funny, fun to talk to. And she might not be able to come until the spring semester, but that will be down the road. So.
Oh, I look forward to hearing about that. That's another topic that's fascinating that we didn't really think about 10 years ago.
No, it's... people used to think about microplastics more from like the beads they put in shower gels for exfoliation on your skin getting in. But now there's just decaying plastics and all sorts of other types of minute particles of plastic in our water supply and wastewater supply that You know, and everything we touch is plastic. So, you know, how those can be brought in. So we'll we'll bring her on down the road too.
Sounds fascinating.
Okay. Well, anything for the good of the cause that you want to say, Greg, before we close up shop?
No, but I'm definitely going to be looking at Halloween in a different light, given this conversation.
Okay. And I hope I didn't creep anybody out. So, but you never know. Like I say, water is interesting all over the place. So I'd like to basically go ahead and close this out. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Hopefully this was a little bit of a different type of podcast for you. And thanks, Greg, for joining in with me on this.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great having you here. And I think if anyone does have any questions or whatever, again, h2opodcast@aol.com. Is our email, and you can always send something if you need it. But I thank everybody for joining us, and good to talk to you again, Greg. And we'll talk to you in about 2 weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tom.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, and have a good one. Talk to you soon.